after weeks of declining numbers, the Delta variant is putting pressure on our local hospitals. Cairo Radio's Heather Bosch reports.
We are very disappointed to be back with you.
Washington State Hospital Association CEO Cassie Sauer explained that several weeks ago, hospital leaders stopped holding regular briefings about COVID as the threat appeared to decline. But Harborview Dr. John Lynch says that was before the Delta variant got a foothold.
It is now the vast majority of all infections in the United States and in Washington State.
This strain is different.
It appears to be very contagious and be making people very sick.
And although you may have heard about breakthrough cases,
even though there are people who are vaccinated who are getting the Delta variant, they're not getting sick. And those who are getting sick are not vaccinated.
Lynch says they're getting very sick.
Here at Harborview, we have two people with COVID who are not vaccinated, who are on heart-lung bypass machines.
Dr. Nathaniel Schlicker is with the Washington Medical Association.
I think we're all struggling to mount again the resolve to climb this hill once more.
Schlicker, an ER doctor, expressing frustration that people are getting sick with COVID when research shows what works. Wear a mask, get a shot.
And we're now at a point where over 4 billion doses, be with a billion doses, a vaccine had been administered in the world, and 346 million in the United States. I think we've now done arguably the largest study in human history to prove that it's safe.
And the concern that once prompted lockdowns is again rearing its head.
Right now, it's pretty universal that every hospital is quite full.
They're taking on another wave of COVID as trauma patients from accidents during the summer typically rise, and there's been a spike in gun violence, all as we face the upcoming cold and flu season. Viruses that, Schlicker says, can also be hindered by wearing a mask.
Pick your reason, wear the mask. Let's try to have a little bit of space this winter left in our hospitals.
Now, while we were sleeping, Simone Biles was leaping and flipping and twisting. Let's go live to Tokyo, Japan, and CBS News correspondent Steve Futterman. Good morning, evening. I don't know what time it is over there, Steve, but welcome.
10:15 tonight in Tokyo. I'm here.
Fantastic. A news correspondent and a time traveler. I want to ask you, Steve. Let's start with the story of the day. Simone Biles.
Yeah.
She was on the balance beam. How did she do?
She did very, very well. Listen, this was a pressure packed performance because of what she's gone through the last week with these mental health challenges. She had withdrawn from a number of events, so I think this may have been the most pressure-packed event she's ever been in many ways. And she came through with a solid performance, not her best performance ever, but I would say in some ways her most impressive performance. She gets a score of 14, an excellent score, and she wins a bronze medal. Most of the people I was speaking with earlier in the day who really cover gymnastics much more regularly than I do, I cover it every 4 years, sometimes every 2 years. But many people felt it was going to be very hard for her to even win a medal, and she does win a medal. She was just a few points, less than a point behind the eventual gold medal winner from China. But it was just a solid performance. She didn't have any major flaws. Had that little second hop on the dismount. You know, you want to nail it, not move at all. She had a hop, but that was basically the only flaw you might find. Her difficulties, I think she lowered some of the difficult moves a bit, and she did say she did change the dismount. She did not want to do these twisting moves. That's what's giving her the mental blocks that she's had the last week or so.
Mm-hmm. How are the Americans doing in general? Were there any other medals this morning?
Yeah, a couple of gold medals. Thing Mo, an American runner at 800 meters, she wins the gold medal at 800 meters. The U.S. also wins a gold medal in wrestling, a silver medal also earlier in the day in the men's 400-meter hurdles. In that race, the Norwegian runner set a world record. He broke his own world record by 3/4 of a second. That is a remarkable, you know, when you try to do it by 1/100 of a second,
yeah.
He did it by 3/4 of a second, broke his own world record. So that was one of the most remarkable events of the day by the Norwegian Wortholm.
Wow. Okay, so before we get into maybe some more specifics, I'd love to broaden out just a little bit here. This is not your first Olympics, is it, Steve?
Not even close.
Yeah.
No.
So how does Tokyo compare to some of your previous experiences, and you can answer either COVID related or just in terms right. of the athletic competition.
I'll tell you, I've been surprised. Obviously, it's a big change because you don't have the fans in the stands. Mm-hmm. That changes the atmosphere. As far as the actual events themselves, covering them, it's been pretty normal. You know, we take the buses from the venues back to the main press center. We always complain the buses are never on time. They usually are. We just want more buses to leave more often. But they're doing I think they're doing a pretty good job right now. They've been presented with a real tough deck of cards here without having the fans, with the COVID issues. And I think they're getting through it quite well. The big concern they've had all along, they did not want to have a big spike of COVID cases in the athletes' village or right. among Olympic participants. Now, there have been a number of people, dozens of people have tested positive, but no major spike or no major, you know, cell that has a large number of COVID cases. I think they're getting through this quite well.
Do you feel safe, Steve?
Oh, yeah, I do. I do. I mean, listen, I'm taking precautions. I wear a brand new N95 mask every single day. I sometimes wonder, my colleagues from other parts of the world, I have a vaccine. Do they have a vaccine? That's the right. only time I sometimes wonder about things. But for the most part, yeah, I feel very safe here.
How is the mood in Japan? Because I know that in the run-up to these games, there was some resistance from yeah. the public.
Yeah, I think once the games began, I think that battle was over. I'm sure there are many people, and not, by the way, on the night of the opening ceremony, I was inside the stadium, you could hear some protest outside. There are people. There's a large number of people who would have preferred the Olympics not be here. My sense, it's not scientific, but my sense is that once the games began and you knew that battle was over, the Olympics were here, I think the Japanese people have basically said, let's accept them. Let's do the best with this as we can. And that's my view of how they've dealt with it here.
Mm. So of the events that remain, are there any that that the U.S. looks to be the favorite?
Oh, sure. I mean, basketball is going to be an adventure. The U.S. men's uh-huh. basketball team makes it into the semifinals. I know a week or so ago after that embarrassing loss to France, a semifinal seemed a long ways away, but the U.S. beat Spain today. They're in the semifinal against either Argentina or Australia, and eventually the U.S. could play France again for the gold medal match. So the U.S. has a chance there. Number of other events tomorrow my time, this evening your time, the U.S. women in the 400-meter hurdles could go 1-2 there. The U.S. has a very strong team. So lots of other medals, opportunities for the U.S. in the days ahead. Obviously, the Olympics close on Sunday.
Steve, have there been any events or athletes that have sort of maybe offbeat, maybe not, that have captured your heart this year? I think about, you know, it seems like every Olympics there's a Norwegian curling team that wears fun pants and sort of captures our attention. And any of that going on for you this year?
And there's a lot of little things. I'll tell you a funny story. This is not quite what you're talking about, but a funny story I heard the other day. I was at been covering a lot of swimming. So I was at the swimming venue when the U.S. men won the 4x100 medley relay. And they had two of those swimmers there were Ryan Murphy, the backstroker, and Caleb Dressel, who does pretty much everything, including the butterfly and the freestyle. Anyway, they were on at the press conference, and Ryan Murphy talked about the first time he met Caleb Dressel. Ryan Murphy was 5 years old. He was competing for a swim team in Florida, a youth swim team, obviously, and he remembered hearing about this really good four-year-old named Caleb Dressel. I mean, this is how far back they go with some of
wow.
this stuff. So it's just remarkable.
Yeah. So when sometimes it happens that, you know, when the world gathers for the Olympics, there are athletes from, let's say, restrictive countries that travel to the games and then try to use that to.
Yeah.
Yeah. To springboard to escape. Any examples of that this year?
We've had a sprinter from Belarus, 24-year-old sprinter. She says that she was being forced to go back to her country and demanded that she'd be kept safe. She did not want to go back to her country. She said she was being forced to go back. As far as we know, she has not gone back. I think she was trying to get a visa from the Polish government. There are a couple of governments who have very testy relationships with Belarus, including Poland and I think the Czech Republic. They both offered her a visa or free passage to go to their country. So we've seen that obviously in the past during the Cold War days. And of course, countries like China and Cuba, there have been many defections over the years. This is an Olympic tradition. One of the biggest attempts for defections, 1956, many of the Hungarian, a number of the Hungarian athletes tried to defect in 1956. After the Soviet invasion of Hungary. So, again, this is an Olympic tradition, part of the world politics. People who live in repressive countries like to be free, and they have an opportunity here, and they often take advantage of it.
That is CBS News' Steve Futterman live from Tokyo. Thank you so much for joining us, Steve.
Great to be with you. Have a great day.
Let's go!
It's time for Choke Points! You have less than a week to figure out how you're going to get into and out of the U District. The Montlake Bridge closes for a month. Starts Monday. Sully's here with the details. Sully!
We've been warning drivers that the Montlake Bridge was going to be closing since early March. I'm not sure if anybody really was paying attention that early in the year, but now it's time. It's go time. For your backup plans and your detour routes, the bridge was built in 1924 and its deck consists of metal grating. Those grates have not been replaced since 1998, and the Washington Department of Transportation's Joe Calabro says it's time for some new ones.
This is an aging metal grid deck with panels that are essentially falling apart. In 2021, our maintenance crews have already responded to the bridge 7 times to make emergency repairs.
And workers had to go out 9 times in 2020 for emergency repairs. During this closure, WashDOT's going to replace all 84 grid decks and add support beams for extra strength. Expansion joints are going to be replaced, and both bridge approaches are going to be repaved. It's a long list of repairs, and that's why the bridge is going to be closed 24/7 for 26 days starting next Monday. The state picked this time because it's after Seafair and before Labor Day when football returns to UW. Calabro expects to see long delays and extra traffic through the neighborhoods as people navigate the closure.
We expect to see plenty of delays on city streets around the bridge as folks seek alternate routes. So we really need people to plan ahead and think carefully about how they'll travel during this closure.
Bus service is also going to be rerouted as well. Bicyclists and pedestrians, though, will still be able to use the bridge during the closure. The sidewalks are going to remain open. Boat traffic through the Montlake Cut will have some new rules as well. Most boats that require openings, like sailboats, won't have much of a problem, but bigger boats will need advance warning.
Right side of the bridge will open on demand for boats that need it. Double leaf openings, so full openings of the bridge, will require 24-hour notice to the bridge operator.
So slightly different rules there, but you should, if you're in a boat owner, you probably know how to navigate what you need to do there. Now, the neighboring 520 bridge project, which is currently finishing up the Montlake lid over the freeway, is going to take advantage of this closure to do some work of its own. Workers there will be removing contaminated soil from the old gas station. That project was going to require its own series of lane closures. Now, those closures are going to be folded into this bridge closure from Montlake. So basically, two projects of gain for only one closure of pain. Upon this closure, well, once it's over in early September, the state's still going to need 5 weekends of work to spruce up the mechanical systems on the bridge, and we'll have the updates on when those closures are going to be once that schedule is out.
Sully, do you have any idea how many bridges, or let's call them exclusive routes, are going to need some work here in the next, I don't know, decade or so?
All the metal bridges in the city basically need a lot of TLC. I mean, the Ballard Bridge, certainly Fremont is going through its paces. Even the University Bridge, which from time to time has to go down for some repairs and whatnot. So, yeah, I mean, those are old steel bridges. They need TLC. So a lot of them are in need of some work, and they do it from time to time. But, yeah, I mean, we've got a lot of bridges in this area. Especially if you work your way over the top side of Lake Union. So, yeah, just and through the locks and whatnot. So yeah, we've got work that needs to be done. That kind of gets folded into all that infrastructure problem.
Yeah, yeah.
When we talk about, I mean, the bridges and thing and roads that need maintenance and a lot of TLC, they fall into that category.
I like to hear that they're combining projects or trying to. I liked your pain and gain, two gains for one pain. That seems smart to me.
Yeah, definitely. And that's one thing WashDOT and a lot of construction agencies have done lately is they're trying to find ways to lessen the delays and the problems for the public. And so this was an opportunity to do two things at once because they're basically in the same area, even though they're two separate projects. They're both under the WashDOT umbrella, so they're working well together. And yeah, they're starting to do that, pay a little bit more attention to the impact on the community.
I know we have to get to traffic here in just a second, but any updates on the West Seattle Bridge?
Oh, yeah, it's still closed.
No, I've noticed. I had to go to West Seattle twice this weekend, and it's just a living nightmare.
Yeah, it's not easy getting around there at all. Basically, we're still on schedule to have it opened about this time next year.
Okay.
That's the plan, is kind of have it done by the end of July and have cars on it maybe that first week in August. That hasn't been accelerated. They do have their contractor on board, and they're still working on it. The plan is still to begin construction in the fall and get going on that.
Okay. Thank you. Since identifying a huge rape kit backlog in 2015, Washington State has made great strides in reforming the way it handles and prioritizes sexual assaults. That includes new laws that aim to improve the way investigators interact with survivors. Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott has the details. Good morning, Hannah.
Good morning, Aaron. So one of the most important tools to getting sexual predators off the streets is the ability to get the survivor of a sexual assault to first report the crime, then be willing to work with law enforcement in the process to get to a prosecutor and hopefully a conviction. The problem?
In the past 3 years, my program has received less than 5 referrals from law enforcement agencies.
For survivors, trust in the system has been lost.
Now, part of the reason for that lack of trust among survivors is the interaction with law enforcement other survivors have had and the dismal outcomes for those who have come forward. A Washington Post analysis recently found less than 1% of reported rapes nationwide led to felony convictions. Similarly, an audit of the King County Sheriff's Department found between 2015 and 2018, a total of 2,571 sexual assaults were reported. Of those, just 163, or 6%, led to convictions. And at the same time, national statistics estimate less than 25% of sexual assaults are ever even reported. Among the many problems with all of that, no evidence makes it into a national DNA database known as CODIS, leaving offenders free to attack again. And survivors don't get the justice they so desperately need. Now, Washington State is leading the way on trying to turn all of those numbers around.
The new Case Review program, actually started as a pilot program last year. That pilot program allowed us to examine case review files, sexual assault case review files from Washington County. And after the success of that program, the legislature decided to expand the case review program into an annual ongoing program that would examine both law enforcement and prosecutorial case files of sexual assault cases throughout Washington State. And each year we will choose a different jurisdiction and examine those case files.
Antoinette Bonciar is a legal and prosecutorial analyst for the Criminal Justice Training Commission.
Examining those case files will allow us to examine the reasons for case attrition. And what I mean by that is why these cases are not advancing forward, why these cases don't lead to arrests, why they don't lead to prosecutions, why they don't lead to convictions. We'd like to examine the reasons for that. For instance, why victims often drop out of the criminal justice process after they report a sexual assault to law enforcement.
Now, they know from talking to survivors that part of the problem is that trust issue, or lack thereof, which can come from the way that investigators interact with survivors or don't interact. That's why there's a new state law that mandates training for sexual assault investigators, specifically on how they interact with survivors.
It's primarily a victim interviewing training. So we'll start the day by just preparing the officers with the information they need to know going into those interviews. We have an advocate and an officer talking about the dynamics of sexual assault and some of the kind of social considerations around that. We have a therapist come in to talk about some of the impacts of trauma on victims and what she's learned through her work with victims of sexual assault over the years and some of the social conditions. We also have an advocate who talks about the importance of connecting victims and survivors to an advocate organization. In addition, we have a sexual assault nurse examiner who talks about her role and the role of SANEs, sexual assault nurse examiners, in that process. Additionally, we have a prosecutor who provides a summary of some of the statutes the officers might need to know going into these investigations.
That's Jen Wallace. She's the lead trainer for this program at the Criminal Justice Training Center. And it's really a training that is first in the nation and leading the way on this type of work.
We bring in some wellness skills. This is another thing that I think distinguishes our training from other trainings. A few of us, have been certified through the Trauma Resource Institute's community resiliency model, which is a set of wellness skills similar to some of the practices officers may already be employing, but we kind of formalize the education on this community resiliency model by bringing in these wellness skills during their interactions with victims. There are things like grounding, like asking the person they're working with to notice maybe their feet, the contact between their feet and the floor or the hands in the desk. And all of these skills are really designed to bring that person back to the here and now and to recognize those moments of maybe severe activation. One of the things we know about officers is that in their role as investigators is they're asking the victims and survivors of that experience to, to some extent, relive that experience by retelling that their narrative. And so when that happens, that could cause a trauma activation, a nervous system activation. So we're training officers in the neurobiology and physiology of trauma and how to recognize that.
The other thing that training includes is, and I believe it's one of the only programs to do this, it has real-life actors come in and and be the survivor, right? The person who's been sexually assaulted, so that the officers get that up-close and personal kind of interaction. Because I can't tell you, and in fact, even Jen Wallace there, she was an investigator for the federal government for many, many years before taking on this position. And part of the reason she took this spot was because when, you know, she handled sexual assault investigations and handled them in the way she believed was the way she should be handling them. But now many years later, we've learned so much about trauma and certain things when it comes to sexual assault that she's I don't want to say guilty, but she feels she wishes she knew then what she knows now.
Sure,
right. So she wants to help other officers learn that. And it makes all the difference. There are survivors who will not take part in the investigatory process if they have a bad interaction out of the gate with an officer.
Sure. Absolutely. Something that I've learned over the last couple years, I have some friends who are involved in trauma and working with people, and the idea that every time you sit down to talk to someone or to give your story, you have to relive that trauma over and over. And so that's something that right away so many people say, I don't want to do that. I just want to get over this and walk the other way. But hearing that there are people who are trying to make that easier and try to talk to and train law enforcement and whoever it may be that is going to deal with these people who have been severely traumatized, that's good news to me.
No, and it's great news. And I've followed our sexual assault reform efforts in the state very closely for many years. So the training is there, and that's been mandated now for 2 years. Now what's new in the law that just passed this last session is this case review. So the case review allows them to pick a jurisdiction every year and go through their case files to make sure that those officers are using this training that they've they've had to interact with those sexual assault survivors. And the overall goal here, obviously, is to get those prosecutions and those charges, convictions and all of that, those numbers up, so you get those offenders off the street, because so many of them do tend to be repeat offenders.
Sure. Yeah. That is Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott. Thank you so much, Hannah.
You bet.
Always good to talk to you.
Oh, it's time for your daily dose of kindness, brought to you by Heritage Homecraft. When native animals from Australia were displaced by those awful wildfires back in 2019, humans definitely stepped in to help. Now, thousands of miles away, outside Chicago, a baby wallaby is under human care. CBS's Adriana Diaz has the story.
At the Brookfield Zoo, outside Chicago, wallabies were brought from New Zealand years ago for their own survival, say animal care specialists Paul Eberhardt and Maggie Chardell.
They were actually planning on doing a cull, which is actually reducing the population. So we brought them over, and they're part of our collection here.
Then last month, baby wallaby named Whitney faced her own survival threat. Her mother had a potentially life-threatening infection.
The decision was made to have us hand-rear Whitney just out of an abundance of caution.
Back to sleep, huh?
That means getting creative.
We really wanted to be able to carry this pouch around with us all day long to mimic all the movements that the mom would be doing.
Do you have any kids, human kids?
No, I do not, but I consider all the animals here, you know, part of my family. So it was kind of like carrying around a little baby of my own.
And you're carrying her around, and I'm carrying this one around. Yeah. And I have to say, I can relate. She looks like a very good eater.
Oh, she's excellent. She finishes most bottles.
They bottle feed her, make sure she exercises, and rotate taking her home at night for late feeds.
She keeps you up at night.
She does, yep. I think all of us are really worrisome parents. So we all check on her even when it's not time to feed her and make sure that she's happy and healthy.
What do you say to folks who don't think animals should be raised by humans at all and that it may not be good for them?
We always try to keep the animal with their parents if possible. But sometimes it's just it's a safety issue for the baby. It's not a decision that's made lightly.
Hi, William.
They say William here is proof. Maggie helped hand rear him when his mother was sick. Now he's back with the others.
Oh, he's so soft. What has this taught you about how we're all so alike? You know, humans, animals.
Well, everybody has similar needs. You know, you need food, you need shelter, you need love.
Yeah, you need love. Where do you sign up to care for wild animals from Australia?
Colleen, I'm telling you, I'm all about it. Yeah.
I want to do that.
I do, too. Special place in heaven for people that look out for the animals, I think.
Yes.
Yeah. Totally sweet. And now, from the G and Ursula Show, weekday mornings, 9 to noon, here on Cairo Radio. Everybody, it's G Scott.
Good morning, Mace.
Good morning, G.
To you, brother. How you doing, man?
I'm doing okay. It's day two. I'm starting to get a little more used to this schedule.
Yeah.
I'm not an early bird, as you know.
Mm-hmm.
But doing okay. I'm excited to talk to you about this, because sometimes, you know, you and I are old friends, and we love to goof around and talk about fun, silly stuff, but there's a serious thing happening, and it's the eviction moratorium expiring. Let me set this up and ask you, because you've got two sides, right? You've got landlords and you've got tenants, and both sides sort of see this as pretty simple, right? For landlords, if you can't pay the rent, then you have to move out. But for tenants who are struggling, it's also simple. There's an airborne plague and I literally have nowhere to go. So what do you make of this, G?
All right. Well, I'm going to try to be nice here, because I know that you and I are going to be on opposite sides of this.
Uh-huh.
And so, first of all, I think the moratorium, I think it should end now.
Okay.
And if for anybody who's upset with me for that comment, my question would be right back to you, then when should it end? I said this last year, no matter what, rent's going to be due. It's not like your debt's going to be clean. Mm-hmm. It's not like you're not going to owe something. You are still going to owe something. Rent is always going to be due. I think that our federal government messed this thing entirely up the entire time.
Hmm.
And here's why. You guys gave PPP loans for businesses. I know business owners who had their best year in 2020. They made good money, the ones that kind of stayed open.
Mm-hmm.
But my question is how long are landlords supposed to go with no rent?
Mm-hmm.
And like this misconception, right? Like people's like, these landlords, you know, do you guys think they're on the beaches in Hawaii sipping on Mai Tais? Come on.
Right.
That's not realistic. These folks is just like everybody else.
In some cases, yeah.
In some cases, you do have some on in Hawaii sipping on Mai Tais.
Mm-hmm.
But most time, that's not the case. So again, I ask, how long should it last? And so the problem is I wish it would have been something to where they said, okay, we're going to give more money. Hear me out here. We're going to give you more money and so that you can make your situation better. But Mace, if I was to ask you to come and do work for me, would you want money or would you want to live rent free? Which one would you want?
Right.
You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So at the end of the day, I don't understand how it will continue to help people by not having them pay rent when one day they will have to pay the rent. Well, so that's the problem.
Okay. So I see the problem as you've got banks at the top,
yes,
that landlords below them owe money to,
okay,
that tenants below them pay the landlords.
Yes.
So why isn't there any effort, or why haven't we figured out how to fix it at the top? Right? At why isn't there some sort of relief for landlords?
There we go.
Or banks.
There we go.
And then you don't have people. Money just doesn't come from nowhere, right? And we are in a, I'm tired of using the word unprecedented this past year and a half, but we are in a situation that we haven't faced before. So why not try something crazy? Otherwise, people, I think I would rather be in some sort of like maybe a little more national debt or maybe a little more financial, I don't know, question marks than having millions of people potentially become homeless, right?
See, now you're getting it. That's exactly. So we are on the same page with this. Again, like I said, at the top, they messed this all up. Hey, as someone who, look, I got a T-shirt. I didn't been evicted before. You feel me? I know exactly what it's like to be evicted. As a matter of fact, the last place I got evicted from, hey, I even cleaned the place up and left the keys right there on the desk. It was right there and renting at the Bristol Apartments, right there, baby. And so, but here's, let me just say this, and folks know what I'm talking about that have been evicted, right? When you get evicted, right, and then you go to try to rent another place,
yeah,
check this out.
Good luck.
Good luck, because that eviction stays on your record.
Right.
And then you go to, you pay the application fees. You know about the application fees, right?
Sure do.
And so here you are paying these application fees, and you're continuing to get denied. So again, this extension, the potential of an extension of this is only going to set people up that are having a hard time to even have a harder time,
yes, sir,
in the future going,
yes,
forward.
Sir.
So my question would be this. For everybody that's mad at me, I get hate mail all the time and I love it. But if you're mad at me, that's cool. How long should it last? When is the date? Should it be today, tomorrow, 5 years, 10 years? How long do you not want people to pay rent?
Let's make housing free. Oh, we're out of time, G. That's it. That's all we got. Never enough time to talk to you, man.
My man, brother.
That is G. Scott, host of the G and Ursula Show, 9 to noon, right after Seattle's Morning News here on Cairo Radio. Seattle's Morning News, Aaron Mason in for Dave Ross. On Tuesday mornings, we go live to our nation's capital and Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter David Farenthold at the Washington Post. Good morning, David.
Good morning.
So I've noticed that in the last week, you've written a couple stories about former President Donald Trump and what seems to be an endless supply of interest, which is how and where Donald Trump may or may not spend what could be his or not his money.
Yes.
What's the latest?
Well, so when he was president, one thing we tracked was sort of the way that Trump used other people's money that he had control of because he was president to help himself and to become made that money his money. That happened because he was president. He could direct taxpayer money into his own businesses by going there and having the Secret Service follow him and then charging the Secret Service to be there. And then also he used the power that he had over his party and his political campaign to funnel millions of dollars to himself. So we're interested in seeing, has he continued those habits after he left office? And the answer in both cases is yes. He's continued to charge the Secret Service. You know, they still protect him, even though he's not president anymore. He's made like $86,000 so far this year by just charging them rent to be near him at his clubs in Mar-a-Lago and Bedminster. And then we also wanted to see, he's got this PAC now, it's got $100 million in it. Was he using it to basically subsidize his businesses like he did when he had a campaign? And the answer also was yes. He's paying $40,000 a month to himself for office space at Trump Tower, paid to rent ballrooms at Bedminster and things like that.
Isn't that illegal? I know there are things set up so that there's a hard line between a president's personal finances and presidential finances. Am I right?
You would think so. It sounds like something that might be illegal, but it's not. In this case, because he runs the kind of PAC that he has, there's almost no limits on what he could do with the money. People give the money. And he asks for money under the auspices of, you know, help me fight for election recounts, help me fight for defeat the Democrats, whatever. But really, he could do whatever he wants to with it. And he could give it to himself. He could spend it at his businesses. You know, there's very little limits. It would be hard to spend this money in a way that was illegal.
I think I've asked you this question before, one of the other times we've talked. But how do you know how much taxpayer money is going to Trump properties via the Secret Service?
We know of, since he left office, at least $86,000. Every night he's at Mar-a-Lago, it's $396.15. Every night he's at Bedminster, where he is now, it's $567. So it seems like that could accumulate for as long as he wants to, as long as he's an ex-president.
Right. And how does that compare to money that we're spending to protect other former presidents, Obama or W?
Well, I haven't really focused on the overall cost. I mean, that obviously is a small fraction of the cost of protecting Trump. There's a bunch of other agents who stay at the, you know, Hampton Inn down the street. The thing that I wanted to compare is not the overall cost of protecting Trump versus Obama versus Clinton versus Bush, but how much is Trump, you know, what part of it does Trump have control over? You know, because Obama, Clinton, Bush, they don't charge the Secret Service anything. They, you know, whatever the Secret Service uses on their properties, they use for free. So Trump has one little piece of it that he can control. He can make it a high expense. He can make it a low expense. He can make it zero. And this is the part that what he's chosen to do with that control is charge the taxpayers money every night.
Mm-hmm. How about when Donald Trump was president, he said that he was not going to take his presidential salary, that he was going to donate that. Did he?
He did. He did for at least the first 3.5 years of his presidency. I can document that every quarter he gave the money away. But in the last 2 quarters of his presidency, so the last 6 months of 2020 and the first 3 weeks of 2021, the White House didn't announce any donations. And I have looked high and low for anybody who might have gotten that money and can't find anything. So I can't prove a negative. I can't tell you Trump didn't give the money away. But I can tell you that there's no sign of that money, and nobody announced it, and I haven't been able to find it.
Hmm. Speaking of rooting through things, I know that I just read that the Department of Justice is saying that that the IRS has to give hand over Donald Trump's tax returns, these documents that people have been asking for years and years and years. As far as I know, at last I heard, Trump said he was still being audited in what has got to be the world's longest audit in history. What's happening? I hate double barreled questions, but let me ask you, what's happening there? And then what will these things tell us? Why is it important?
Well, so the House Ways and Means Committee, under law, they can ask for anybody's tax returns. Their job is to oversee the tax code, so they can ask for anybody's tax returns to see how it's working. And so they asked for Trump's. Trump's administration made up a reason not to give it to them. And the Biden administration has now said, okay, you know, there's no exceptions in this rule. If they ask for a tax return, we have to give it to them. So they're giving it to them. That doesn't mean that the Congress is going to publish Trump's tax returns tomorrow. They're not allowed to just basically dump it on the internet, let everybody look at it. I do think we will see some portion of it maybe in a report they write about, you know, things they found and how Trump was subverting the law if they find that. If I could see them all, there's a number of things that I think we might learn. You know, how much money is Trump making? Is he in financial distress? Does he need outside investors? But also, you know, was he paying his taxes? Was he skirting the tax code even while he was technically in charge of enforcing the tax code? The New York Times had some great stories last year about how little Trump paid in taxes while he was president, like $750 a year total. You know, I want to know, did he follow the law? Was that just really good but legal creative accounting, or did he break the law somewhere?
Right. And finally, where are we on that weird Arizona recount of the 2020 election?
It is a shambling to its conclusion.
Okay.
So they've now, after months and months, they said they'd be done in May, I think, or April. Anyway, they've now given back the ballots. They don't have the ballots anymore, and they're writing a report. But, you know, even in Arizona, where the Republicans started it, there's been a lot of criticism by Republicans that this has just gotten out of control. It's being run by amateurs. Nobody, you know, trusts the result they're going to produce. And that even the Senate president, who was the one who kind of started the ball rolling here, she has started to kind of pre-make excuses about why it won't be very good. She started to say, well, we wanted this extra thing and the county wouldn't give it to us. We wanted this and we couldn't get it. So she's sort of already making excuses for the shortcomings of the audit. We haven't seen it. I'm sure, given the biases of the people who are running that audit, they will find something to criticize. But I don't think it's going to be what Trump and everybody else had hoped, which is incontrovertible proof that the election was stolen in Arizona. The election's been audited in Arizona. And it wasn't stolen. You know, this, I don't think, will really change that outcome.
That is Pulitzer Prize winning reporter David Fahrenthold at The Washington Post. Thank you so much, David.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News, the podcast. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. You can find our podcast weekday mornings right at 9:30.
And if you subscribe, you'll never miss the Daily Dose of Kindness.